Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted that Bremont will be sponsoring the Money Maze podcast throughout this year. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch, brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. Stuart Henderson Britt, a guru of marketing, once observed, "Doing business without advertising is like winking at a girl in the dark. You know what you're doing, but nobody else does." And if there was ever an industry reinventing itself, it's advertising and marketing communications. And if you want to have a conversation with the undisputed king of this industry, you'd choose my guest today. He is an immense business builder, adapter, survivor, and winner, a person most CEOs want to hear to help them understand how to deliver their message in a digitally dominated, attention-deficient world. And here on the Money Maze podcast, we're attempting to understand the powerful forces driving business and investing, especially when there are industry-changing shifts underway. So today's guest is the chief executive of S4 Capital, founder of WPP, Sir Martin Sorrell. Martin, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thanks, Simon. I'm executive chairman, just to set the record straight. And I wish all of what you just said was true. There are parts of it which are probably prone to exaggeration. But that's what a lot of people say advertising people do. So you're in good company.
I wouldn't know about exaggeration. Let's start with your background. I know you studied economics at Christ College, Cambridge. You went to Harvard Business School. But just dialing back, what were you like as a child?
Awful. Spoiled Jewish child, northwest London in the ghetto. Only child. I had a brother who died about a year before I was born, and so I was at the Last Chance saloon. My mother, well, she used to wrap everything up in plastic. It was amazing to me that I didn't get wrapped up in plastic and shoved in the fridge or in a cupboard somewhere. So I was spoiled. My father never had an education. My father and mother left school when they were 13. And so they lavished an education on me. I went to, started at Hasmonean Prep School, I think I was, which is a Jewish day school when we lived at Henley's Corner. And then when we graduated, if that's the right word, to Mill Hill, I moved to Goodwin and then Haberdashers Prep and Haberdashers Senior School. And as you said, Cambridge and Harvard. So I was extremely fortunate, and everything my father didn't have, and my mother didn't have, they lavished on me. So I was, as I say, spoiled only child.
But who or what lit the fires of your burning ambitions?
Well, it's a good story. A good question that my father did. And he introduced me to Charles Haywood, who was my father's boss. I remember we went to lunch one Sunday in Sussex. It was a place called Warning Lid, which was interesting because it's where they lit the fires for the Armada, to warn for the Armada. So it was a pretty historic house and historic spot. Anyway, Charles Haywood said to me, I think it must have been about 14, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? I said, sort of, it was a bit like The Graduate, you know, please, sir, I want to go into business. So he said, well, if you're into business, you should go to Harvard Business School. I always remember that. So it sort of registered with me. But when I went to Cambridge, I really didn't make the best out of Cambridge, I think. I couldn't allocate my times effectively. And anyway, I applied straight to HBS, Harvard Business School, because it was a time when the draft was biting at its hardest in America. So a lot of Americans were going straight from undergraduate school to graduate school. It was an unusually naive class. The dean of admissions, Dean Athos at Harvard, said it was the most naive class that the business school had ever had. And by that, he meant it was the youngest in part. apart from being naive. So the average age was about 24, and I was the second youngest there. I was 699th in the ranking. There was only one person younger than me in the 700. But I really enjoyed that, and I found my feet there. And I think that's the pressure cooker, to answer your question head on. I think all those things I mentioned influenced me, but I think the real pressure cooker came with HBS and having three case studies a day. What should the chairman do and why? And I think that's what sort of pushed me hard.
So you then, I think, joined Mark McCormack.
I had met Mark McCormack at the B School in the second year. There was a course called Management in New Enterprises, MNE, and they were case studies on successful entrepreneurs. But for one of the successes that breezed through and talked about there, the unqualified success was Mark McCormack. So I kept in touch with him whilst I was at B School and afterwards when I was at Glendenning. And he was always on at me to come and join. And he said, why did you come to the UK to start what was called then IMG, or International Management Incorporated, IMI, I think it was at that time. It had a literary operation, ILM. It had film operation, TWI. It had merchandising operation, Arnold Palmer's clothing and apparel, Golden Bear Enterprises, which was Jack Nicklaus. So, I mean, they had really Gary Player's, what's it called, the Black Knight was his symbol and merchandising. So he said, come and run the UK. Well, there wasn't anything to run. But when I landed in London, I found that two other people had been offered the same job. The three of us were sort of scrambling over one another. But I enjoyed it, and I stayed with him for about 2 or 3 years and then decided to leave. I tried to do something with my father, actually, and it was quite a funny story. My father said, what do I say to Mark? Because I was a bit in awe of Mark. So my father said, well, why don't you write him a letter saying, you know, you want a temporary leave of absence because you want to go and do some stuff with father and some enterprise efforts with him. So I wrote the letter. So that was about 1972. And of course, when fast forward to WPP or Warren Plastic Products, when we made the hostile bid for J. Walter Thompson, which got a lot of ink, which was 1987. And Mark had this habit of going back through his file. A year on, he would say to his secretary or officer, bring me the file from this day a year ago. So he would always go through it. He did it every year, but not just 1 year, go back. So I left in 72, and in 1987, when all the articles hit about the successful hostile bid for JWT, he wrote me a letter saying, are you still on temporary leave of absence? So it was great. I got into contact with Morris and Charles, mostly Morris. Morris was looking for a CFO, and there was a headhunter called Brian Burwash at Goddard Payne Rogers, and Brian was having a conversation with Morris, and Morris was frustrated because he kept on seeing these CFOs from various newspapers and newspaper groups, and he had to see them about 11 o'clock in the morning because if you saw them at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, they were the worst for wear. So Morris kept on saying to Brian, got to find somebody. And Brian said, well, what sort of person do you want? He said, Morris said, somebody like Martin, because I was doing some consulting work and I had an office in Charlotte Street, Sarge's offices. And Morris said, somebody like Martin. So Brian said, well, have you asked him? And Morris said, no. So he said, Brian said, I'll go and ask him. And that was it. So I went to work for Sarches as their CFO, had a great time for 9 years. And then at the ripe old age of 40, in accordance with my father's advice, he said, find an industry you enjoy, find a company you enjoy and build a reputation. And if you fancy doing something on your own, go off and do something on your own when you're around 40. So I was 40 and I did that. And the rest is history. Then WPP and now S4.
Right. So just pause there. You joined Saatchi & Saatchi. You were often referred to as the third brother.
There were about 25 third brothers. I mean, there was, right. Tim Bell was probably, to be fair, the third brother. But there was Jeremy Sinclair, Bill Muirhead. That was probably the group. And then myself on the financial side. And with Michael Johnson and David Perring. I mean, there were lots of people around them. But a bit romantic to call me the third brother. In fact, Morris and Charles did have two brothers, I think, so there was a third and a fourth brother.
But Saatchi was best of breed. Was this an industry ripe for disruption, or had it just got too cozy?
Well, the IPA at that time, the Incorporated Practitioners in Advertising, had, an unwritten rule that you didn't pitch one another's clients. If you were a member of the IPA, you didn't pitch your clients. So it would be a complete joke. And so it was a cozy oligopoly. And the same was true in America. I mean, the American agencies were licenses to print money. You got 15% commission. And if you're working for Procter, the agencies never changed. The relationships were always in place. And you got 15% of the billings and 17.65% on the production cost. And, you know, today people would laugh at that. But again, that was a cozy, they were all private partnerships, but they were run sort of as feudal kingdoms. And of course, Procter, for example, I remember we did the Pampers. We were working on Pampers at Saatchi's in Europe. And they set up a paper mill in America to make these paper diapers. And they tested them and they stress tested them. So we never got paid anything because we were on commission and billings, 15% of billings. But we never got paid anything in the development phase. When they launched the product, what they did was they set a market share objective. They would say, we want 15% or 20%, 25% of the diaper market. And they would spend on TV, basically, until they got there. So it was Roy Thomson's famous words, I think, about television, wasn't it? Television licenses, a license to print money. And that has all changed, of course. But was it ripe for disruption? Yes, because it was old boys' club. It was a very, dare I say it, waspy old boys' club, which was to be broken into. And that's what the brothers did. They flouted the conventions, super creative, super aggressive, super fun, great environment. Very difficult to replicate that ever. I mean, I think at S4 we have a similar group, maybe in some respects even better, but it was a unique group and a unique group of people.
So before we talk about S4, I just want to touch on longevity, because in a world of short attention spans and telescoped expectations, it's perhaps not surprising that I read the average life of a UK CEO is now just over 5 years. Now, you were the longest serving chief executive of a FTSE 100 company. You were CEO of WPP for 33 years, building it, as many will know, from a £1 million shell company in 85 to 16 billion when you left. My question is, can you explain that longevity and why you broke the mold?
Well, first of all, I was a little bit of a cheat because I think we only got into the FTSE in 97. So I was only CEO of a FTSE company for 23 years or whatever, even less. But, you know, I was CEO of the company for a long period of time. We had our ups and downs. I mean, we had a near-death experience in 91, 92, when we had to restructure the company after Ogilvy. We funded it through half convertible preferred. And I forgot that when stock markets fall, convertible preferreds become debt, or convertible preferreds are debt in any circumstance. I always remember there was a guy at the Prue. We did it by rights issue, the convertible preferred. I remember as we were walking out of the interview, he said to me, Martin, anything you can do with a convertible preferred, you're better off doing, or you can do with equity. And he was dead right, because when we restructured the company and, you know, we did the debt for equity swap, I calculated, you know, if we'd done what he'd suggested, you'd done a straight equity offer instead of convertible preferred. And in those days, the convertible preferred was, I think it was 6.7% net, but you didn't get a deduction. So it cost about 10% gross, which was huge and was just too much leverage, and we had to do it. So we had the perils of Pauline. We had our ups and our downs. That was the, I suppose, down. And then we recovered from that. And in the 90s, we had a very good run from 85 to 91. And then in the 90s, we focused on organic growth. And then our big breakout transaction was in 2000 with Y&R, where we did a share swap, basically, merger of unequals. We were sort of roughly 2-1 in terms of size. It was about a $4 billion deal, I think, in terms of market value. And then from there, Gray, which was a great deal, and TNS, et cetera, and took us through. So I think the answer, that's the sort of history. The answer to the question is, it goes back to what Dad said. His view was, I mean, he thought that portfolio you'll find this amusing, I think, portfolio investment was a mug's game. It was like going to the casino, which is ironic in these days of what goes on with GameStop and everything else.
Full circle.
He basically believed that you should invest in the company which you knew best, which is the company you worked in. Now, that went counter to all good investment advice, which said don't have your pension and your investment in the same company. You know, it's too risky. So I agree with him, or I followed his advice. And I would reinforce that even further. I think where management, the mark of a good company is when management and control are concentrated in the same people. In other words, I think what the biggest problem with listed companies is that management rarely has significant equity investment in the company. I think the separation of ownership and control is, I'm going to say, a mistake, which is probably too extreme. But I would say if I was running an investment portfolio or an investment fund, I would be looking for those people who put their money where their mouth is. That's not to say everything is about financial returns, but it's to say that I think that concentrates the mind. And I would go further than that. I think that controlled companies, this is against good corporate governance, in inverted commas, controlled companies are more effective than uncontrolled. I mean, I think Rupert Murdoch is a great example. I mean, he controlled the company with a disproportionate amount of the voting, 40% of the shares and 10% of the economic interest, whatever it was. But you knew with Rupert that he would always make, and still does, long-term decisions in the company. So all the stuff about ESG, which we subscribe to violently at S4, but my view is that can be taken care of by saying, if you have control over the company, you take into account long-term needs. If you say you're in business for the short term, you're going to maximize profits in the short term, you're obviously going to do things which are detrimental to each of their stakeholder groups. So I think we overcomplicate this. It's very simple. So long-term brand building is what my dad said. And the final point on it is it's counterintuitive today. That is not what people believe today. Younger people, I think, believe that you try and get experience in, you flit from flower to flower. You don't build a long-term career with one company, employer, whatever it is, that you are better off going from, as I said, one flower to the other. And they may be right. It's not just the average life of a CEO in listed companies, 5 years. McKinsey, I think, did a study where the average life of a company in the S&P or the FTSE 100 is 17 years. So on that basis, WPP was 33 years. And even being in the FTSE for 21 or whatever it was, they had outlived the average life. So it may be that my dad's wrong in today's context, that the life of the company is so compressed and the changes are so violent, the technological changes are so violent, that long-term brand building doesn't work anymore.
Well, it was interesting. We had Sir Chris Hone on the show, and he became a big shareholder in News Corp when they were really depressed, probably now 7 or 8 years ago, for many of those, I think, many of those reasons about the sort of long-term ownership. So let's talk about S4. I read your company's annual report entitled Swallows and Albatrosses. And for anybody listening, I think it's a really well-written, lucid...
A rollicking read.
Yeah, it is. For those of us who don't know much about your world, it was really insightful. I'm going to quote one sentence, which is, "How's it going?" I asked the CEO of a consumer goods company. The blunt response came back, "Nothing that another 100 basis points of top-line growth couldn't solve." So that's where S4 comes in. Tell us about the mission.
Well, having left WPP at the age of, grand old age of 73, I was probably a little bit tired with wrestling with 2 or 3 or 4% top-line growth, if that. And certainly since about 2016, maybe 2016 was the highest point, but from about 2017 onwards, so for about a year really, it had been difficult and we were flatlining. And when I left for three reasons. One is that I was upset with the way the board handled things, particularly the chairman, and who came from the engineering industry and really, I don't think, understood the business very well. Still doesn't, I don't think. And I thought, therefore, I had a point to prove. And the point to prove was that we could build a digital force, which wasn't constrained and didn't have the albatross around its neck of the analog company. That was one thing. Second thing was I didn't want to do portfolio stuff. I just don't enjoy, again, flitting from flower to flower with obviously interesting situations, but with no responsibility. And then thirdly, I have my mother's genes. And so it probably means that, as my son said, I'll die in seat 1A. And I can't conceive of sort of sitting at home or on the beach somewhere twiddling a thumbs. I can do that for 10 days happily. But after that, it gets a bit tiresome. And even on those 10 days, I'm seldom off what used to be my BlackBerry and now my iPhone. So I sort of thrive on that. And I can't. And I think if you stop doing something full time, you vegetate. I thought what we should do is focus fully on digital, because if you look at the media marketplace, which is $550 billion last year, and marketing services about another $500 billion, and then trade budgets, which are about another $700 billion, $800 billion. So it's a total of about $1.7-1.8 trillion. If you look at that market, it's the digital part of it that's growing, and it's the digital part of it that you have to focus on. And like even last year, COVID year, traditional might have been down 10 or 15%, but digital was probably up somewhere between 0 and 5%. And this year, digital will be up 20%, particularly on the back of this massive, I think, GDP recovery we're going to see as a result of the COVID bounce back both this year and next year, so 21 and 22. But this year, digital will be up 20%, and traditional probably be up about 5%, and the overall will probably be up about 12%. But digital last year passed traditional more than 50% of the market. This year will be well over 50%. It's forecast to be 70% by 2024. So there were four things that I was focused on. One was digital only. Two was trying to put together a model which was fit for purpose. We think the old agency holding company model, of which WPP is a part, really has been in existence really for 70 years, since Marion Harper in the 1950s. People think it was WPP or Saatchi's or Omnicom Publicis, and it's not true. It goes back to Marion Harper in 1950s, and that, so it's been going for 70 years or so, and that's a market share model. You have different brands, and they cannibalize one another. Those are like P&G or Unilever detergents, but you accept that because you improve your market share. So the second thing was to create the new model. And the new model is data-driven. So it's first-party data-driven, very important now with the third-party cookies being under pressure from Google and from Apple. So first-party data to create digital advertising content in real terms, and then distribute that content, get the results, and then distribute it through digital media, get the results, sort of reposition, redo the content depending on the results you get there. So continuous loop, rather like an election model, but without an election date. So that second principle, I call it our constitution. First is solely digital, because that's where the growth is. Secondly, the Holy Trinity model of first party data driving creation of digital content and being distributed by digital media in a continuous loop. Thirdly, faster, better, cheaper. And that's our mantra and go-to-market, or speed, quality, values. Faster means agility. Speed means agility. Better or quality means understanding the digital ecosystem. And cheaper or value is about efficiency. Because despite the fact that things have probably improved a little bit from a growth point of view, at least for a couple of years, or more than a little bit for a couple of years, I mean, generally the model of GDP growth is about 2, 3 or 4%. There's very little inflation, certainly since 2008, and therefore very little pricing power, so clients focus on cost. So those are the three sort of go-to-markets, and the better and the quality is worth spending a little time on that. That's understanding what 20 or so companies are doing agnostically. We're not a tech company, we're not MarTech, we're not AdTech, but we understand the relative strengths of hardware, software, and platforms, the companies around that, and how they're changing over time. For Clubhouse or TikTok or Epic Games, Fortnite, Unreal Engine, which enables us to create content in one location from anywhere in the world, understanding those relative merits of the technology. So the companies we look at, obviously the six platforms, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Tencent, Alibaba, TikTok, Apple and Microsoft, Oracle, Adobe, Salesforce, IBM, SAP, Twitter, Snap, Pinterest, Spotify, Netflix, LG, Samsung, Xiaomi, JD.com, Epic, and others. So there's about 20 or so companies, and those companies will ebb and flow, and we're agnostic about them. And our role is to try and advise clients on it. So that's the third principle. And the fourth principle is a unitary structure. The old holding company structure is a fragmented structure. You know, deals are done on earnouts. We don't do deals on earnouts. We do half shares, half cash. And we, coming back to this ownership and control not being separated, we want people to have slugs of equity in the company that they build over time. Because when you create an earnout structure, you tend to fragment it too much. So those are the four constitutional principles. The mission is to create a new model. So we want to create a new advertising and marketing services model, and we want to disrupt the old. So there is a disruptor. This is, it's grand to compare it to Tesla or Amazon, but we are in the disruption business. We are there. We are basically saying the existing model isn't fit for purpose. It's been around too long. And it doesn't work, and you need a new model. And so twofold thing. One is create a new model, and secondly, it's to disrupt the old.
Now, you've written that strong brands are building direct links to the consumer. I wasn't sure I completely understood that.
Well, what has happened, if you go back to the web for a minute, when that happened, I think our clients, manufacturers, let's say, were very enthusiastic and happy about that because they thought that would enable. Before that, they had Tesco, Carrefour, Walmart interposed between themselves and the consumer. You know, when the consumer goes into the store, you can have own label, private brands, but the retailer controls the supermarket or the store, and the manufacturer doesn't. When the web came along, we thought that they would have direct access to the consumer, and that would enable them to establish a stronger relationship. Unfortunately, or whatever, the traditional retailer was displaced by the e-tailer, really, effectively a Google, a Facebook, or an Amazon, or Alibaba, or a Tencent, TikTok in a Chinese context or Eastern context. And particularly since 2016, when we had the brand safety issues, the interference in elections issues, the privacy issues, the platform said, we're going to put the walls in the walled gardens, as we call it, higher. And manufacturers are not going to be able to deal as directly with consumers. So Unilever goes and buys Dollar Shave Club. I don't think Paul Polman or Unilever really wanted Dollar Shave Club to poke Procter in the eye on Gillette. What they really wanted to do was to build direct relationships with consumers, which I think was the right thing to do. And it's become even more so because I mentioned Google are nixing third-party cookies, which is use of third-party data, as is Apple. And what that means is our clients are being forced back to use their first-party data assets, which they have to make sure consumers know what they're letting themselves in for when they sign up. And also, if consumers want to use their data to sell their data, because they, after all, the data is mine or yours, consumers should be in a position where they can choose either to sell it for money or some sort of bargain. Return for me giving you my data. I get certain benefits or discounts or whatever it happens to be. So I think what's happened is that the internet, the web, has morphed into a situation where the platforms, the intermediaries, are new. They are e-intermediaries. So they've Walmart and Tesco and Carrefour. I mean, they are building their own direct relationships through the web. And you see that Walmart linking up with Google to do that against an Amazon. But essentially, the internet did not fulfill its promise from a manufacturer's point of view. They thought they were going to have direct relationships and unfettered. The CEO of Procter used to talk about the last mile in the store, you know, getting control of that because consumers are coming to the store and the retailer could influence the consumer in store, you know, with shelf wobblers or whatever it happens to be in order to get them to buy stuff. And we thought it was going to be displaced, but it wasn't. So that control wasn't there. And so brands have to build. I mean, this is absolutely crucial. I mean, in the current context, I think marketers have to take back control. They have to embrace agility because 24/7, always on world, they have to be agile and they have to use first-party data.
So what is worrying CEOs most?
It's what you pulled out of the report, that 100 basis points of organic growth. That's the key. there are other really important things. But if you said to me, it's top line growth. Most listed companies trogging along at GDP growth of 2-3 or 4%, certainly since 2008. So if you can get your top line to grow at 2-3 or 4%, and you can cut your costs, and you can buy back stock, you can increase your EPS at 0-5 or 5-10%. If you last on average for 5 years, that's a perfectly respectable legacy. What COVID did was to blow a hole in that. I mean, Q2 of last year, you know, banks' profits were down by 50%. The ad agencies were off by 50%, making massive provisions. And most sectors, not every sector, but most sectors were really hit very hard. So everybody is looking, or in my view, should be looking for that top line growth. Now, that's the reason why M&A activity is so strong as well, because there are two ways you can get the growth. You can organically grow it, or you can acquire a company that you think will give you a better organic growth rate. You know, in our own case, you'll see what our results are, but we did very well in the COVID year from an organic point of view. We budgeted 30% growth, like for like, and the market's expecting anywhere between 15 and 20%, and we'll definitely be at the north end of that when we report. And our growth through deals this year will probably be, well, we've started off the year with a little bit of a mini bang, and we're sort of 20-25% up in terms of size because of the deals we're doing. So you can envisage something growing at 25% organically for this year and 25% through deals. And so we mirror, I think, what, and when we merge with companies, as we put it, although the organic, obviously, doesn't affect the organic growth in the year of the deal, in future deals, if the acquired company or merged company grows faster, it has a positive impact on your organic growth rate. And that's what CEOs are looking for. So why do I think CEOs are being quite aggressive on the deals front? It's not just because of cheap money and stock market valuations. It's because they see it as a way. And you look at the holding companies, most of them, probably the highest concentration of digital activity is about 40% of their total sales. So they have to get their digital content up. It means their 40% might be growing. It's their 60% that is falling down a plug hole. You know, that's the analog part, which is dragging them down. I mean, most of the holding companies last year, if the market's expecting us to be up 15 or 20% organically, it will be from a smaller base. Most of the holding companies are down 5-10%. Or more percent. So there is a something like a 25 to 30% difference in our growth rate and theirs, which is a huge difference. And the reason for that is we're totally focused on digital. Yeah, I don't think, by the way, I don't think their digital parts are growing as fast as ours are, but directionally, so the holding companies, I think their only salvation is to be broken up.
I guess that's my question, is that you say is absolutely clear, but you remain a shareholder of WPP.
Yeah, but that's emotional. That's not rational. I'm rather hoping a private equity house would come along and break it up. There is more value there than the sum of the parts is greater than this valuation. And Group M on its own in media is probably worth the market value. Well, not probably. It is worth the market value of WPP on its own.
Let's talk about big tech in the future. Rick Saunders, who used to run a chunk of Deutsche Bank's equity business, said he heard you say at a conference last summer that Amazon and Apple, that were valued then at $1.4 trillion, would crack the $2 trillion mark in short order, which they did, which was a bold and prescient statement. But my point is, tech, for those of us who have been around for a while, is cyclical.
I don't think tech is cyclical. I think it's cyclical from an investment point of view, in the sense that people will move from growth to value and vice versa. But it's not, the tech itself is not cyclical, it is secular. And there will be, so S4 context, okay, we're digital is 50% of the market. It'll get to 70, according to the analyst Michael Rubenstein and others, by 2024. It'll get to 100%. Then we have to pivot, you know, whether it's AR or VR or AI or voice or whatever it is, we have to pivot. But there will be, you know, I mentioned the Epic thing. So just worth going through that story. We deal a lot with the new tech companies. And about a year ago, remember on our daily management call, I think it was Victor or Wes said, you know, our people are getting very excited about this Epic Fortnite games technology. This is just when COVID was starting. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, we can, in fact, there was a story in the New York Times about it, because we used, one of our people in New York used the Fortnite game as a way of meeting with clients. You had an avatar in the game and the client had it and you were talking to one another through it. But he said, well, we can use this Unreal Engine technology to create digital content anywhere in the world, London, whatever. And we can put Simon into an ad, Simon and Martin into an ad from Rio de Janeiro. But we're building, we've just taken over the CNBC TV 18 studio in Mumbai. New Delhi. And we're building an epic games Fortnite called a technology called the Unreal Engine, which will enable us to shoot digital content from anywhere in the world. So we can recreate, and it's beautifully done, the quality is amazing. We can recreate any place in the world in New Delhi and shoot the content in the 24/7. So it's really using, point of the story is that we're continuously using and changing. You know, Clubhouse becomes a bit of a phenomenon at the moment, or, you know, more relevant, TikTok, which grew to 8 billion. I mean, it's worth going through the numbers. You know, if digital is 275 billion or whatever it is, 250, 275 billion, Google's about 180 billion of ad revenues, Facebook's about 80, Amazon's about 20, TikTok's 8. Snap had a good year, 2.5. Pinterest and Twitter less. So the dynamics are quite interesting. The dominance of the big platforms, along with the three Chinese ones, Alibaba, Tencent, TikTok, is huge. And I see no reason why that 2 trillion valuation can't be eclipsed. Now, you remember Lloyd Blankfein said when market values of Apple or whoever passed a trillion, he was asked, who would be the first company to get to 2? I guess it was Saudi Aramco, but get to 2. And he said, well, no nation state will probably let a company get to 2 trillion because they're getting pretty big. But, you know, I think what's going to happen on tech, I don't know, but I would guess they will find it extremely difficult to make any deals, acquisitions, because of the regulation. I think the stuff that came out of Congress about the chat inside Amazon and Facebook about their acquisitions and the stuff about, you know, how they would deal with those acquisitions if they weren't, they didn't respond to their blandishments. I don't think that did anybody any good. And I think there will be tremendous pressure to prevent them. I've always seen pressure on news and search in Australia and talk now of it being in other, you know, Google's had to pay for news snippets in France. Matt Hancock, I think it was yesterday, was talking about the British should do something, which I totally disagree with. There's one place we should be encouraging these companies to come to with all the things we have to deal with, plus Brexit. It's making friends with them, not enemies of them. But I think it's likely they will find it very difficult to do deals. I don't think they'll get broken up. And even Scott Galloway, who's a big proponent of breaking Amazon and others up, did admit, you know, AWS on its own become bigger than Amazon.
But how do you deal with this issue of trust? Because we've had Merkel responding to Twitter, shutting down the Trump feed. We've got controls that are part of the way of life in China. I'm told by somebody who's been in advertising for a long time that UK government won't allow their media advertising to use YouTube. So where do we go with this?
Well, it's, I think, with when those companies got to $1 trillion, with power comes responsibility. And I think they have done, to be fair to them, people may think I'm being overly fair, they have responded. Google has stopped political advertising. Facebook has even stopped political advertising at certain times. Twitter has done that. Facebook have hired at least 35,000 people, maybe more, to monitor advertising content. Look, it's inevitable. This is the problems of success. I remember talking to one of the tech company's executives, must have been in 2017, and she was saying to me, this is 2017, so this is 3 or 4 years ago, and she was saying all the pressure that she was under from a regulatory, something had happened that week, I can't remember what it was, and we were having a conference on their campus, and she said to me, and I said, look, it goes with the territory. I mean, other people would like your problems. You know, you're so successful, you're growing like a weed. What this means, this is life, and this is going to be your life for many, many years, which is, you know, you have tremendous power, and with that comes responsibility. So a greater proportion of your P&L or your costs that you spend in your P&L are going to have to be devoted to dealing with these issues. And, you know, now the tech companies, you know, when I did my first interview at Cannes, I mean, it must be about 10 years ago, I had the Cannes debate. I had four people on the stage, and I had somebody from Google, I had somebody from Facebook, I had somebody from Yahoo, wherever it was. And my first question to the four of them on the panel was, you know, are you a tech company or a media company? And they all said, we're tech companies. And I said, no, you're not. You're a media company. You're responsible for the content that goes through the pipes. They are now talking that way. They are saying we are responsible in a, I guess, in a perverse way. Facebook is saying, by pulling out of news in Australia, we're responsible for the content. I mean, they're being forced to pay for it, rightly or wrongly. In a funny way, they're sort of making their choice. I mean, somewhat controversially, but they are making their choice. So I think it's inevitable that this is going to become more and more significant and more important. And the big tech, there are the six that I mentioned, basically. Those are the ones we're talking about. I mean, there are others as well that have tremendous power, like Apple and Microsoft, etc. But those six are going to have to invest, in inverted commas, in more control of what they do, because I think the pressure is going to intensify.
So back to S4 Capital, you have described your growth as growing violently. You've also, and I was intrigued, said that your competition is in two flanks, Accenture at one level and private equity at another. And just tell me a little bit about that.
That's on deals. I mean, on the client side, I would say it's at sort of three levels. There's the specialists like Oliver and Jellyfish on the digital media side, Oliver on the content side. Then you go to the holding companies where parts of them like Huge or RGA or VML or Essence or AKQA we compete with. We don't compete with the holding companies as a whole. And then, but from an overall point of view from client, it would be Accenture. We competed with them on Mondelez, BMW, Mini. And then on the deal side of the business, I would say private equity.
The market cap of your company is now just under 3 billion. WPs, I think, is just around 10. Do you think the Citi understands these businesses?
Yeah, I think they're getting to understand it. I mean, the problem, of course, in Europe, and everybody complains about it, is, and I heard it again last night on the call, there are very few tech businesses to buy into in Europe. And the simple fact, and it's the sad fact, is the US values tech businesses at a higher rates. If you look at our share price performance, it's been, I was looking at it again this morning, we're better than Globant and we're better than the Trade Desk, which since we relisted on September the 13th, 2018. Now, if we'd been in America, we might have been, you know, we do have American investors, but we need to develop our investor base. I mean, the fact is the Americans understand these businesses better, sadly. I'd love to reverse into an American company, you know, as long as we could get the social issues right. Love to reverse into a big American company. I think that would be the way forward. That would be the best way forward.
It was interesting. We had Sir Xavier Rolet on the show about 6 months ago, and he really diagnoses one of Europe's problems in developing these tech companies, which is about the capital market structure and reliance on debt versus equity, which, for anybody who hasn't listened, is, I think, really insightful. I'd like to talk about resilience. You are probably a standout example of somebody from the late 70s who's been up and down and up again. And where does that resilience come from?
Immigrant grandparents. I was talking to a Cambodian woman on the weekend who was in Cambodia when she was five, and her father came home. He worked for the government. He was an architect, and he wore glasses, and Pol Pot killed people who wore glasses. And he came home literally one day, and there were eight kids, I think, or seven kids, and said to his wife, who was pregnant, "You have to leave now." And they drove to the Cambodian Thai border. The wife took her jewelry, and they used her jewelry for favors to get through the border, and they managed to get into Thailand. When you hear stories like that, any difficulties pale into insignificance. So I think the answer is nowhere. Well, I mean, who knows? Because I don't know what the details were. But my father's parents came here in 1899 with nothing, I think from Kiev and the Ukraine. And I found their wedding certificate, and I don't know whether it was they got married in Stepney in East London or whether they reaffirmed their vows having married in the Ukraine. But they signed the wedding certificate with a cross, and the four witnesses signed with a cross. So none of them knew how to speak a word of English. Probably it was Yiddish, Russian, German, whatever. So I think you have to be resilient, because others have gone through, in the Cambodian example, it was staggering. 4 million people, 2 million people were murdered. So that was another Holocaust. So I think you just have to, everybody has their ups and downs. Every day has its ups and downs. The trick is, everybody makes mistakes each day. The trick is to make more positive decisions than negative ones, or have more wins than losses. I think that's why immigrants are such an important driver in any economy. You know, I resent, abhor the anti-immigrant sentiment.
So I had to smile. For those old-timers who think about getting across the border in an emergency, it's better to have a little gold stashed away than Bitcoin when you're trying to strike that deal.
Maybe Bitcoin is the answer. Who knows? As long as you remember the code, you're okay.
Now, so you are 75. We actually are members
six.
Of the same...
Six. I'm 76, 76. Last weekend.
So you're right. 76. Congratulations. Well, you and I are actually in the same gym, although we haven't met until today. But you also have your finger on the pulse of this commercial changing world. What drives you?
What drives me?
Yeah.
Well, I think the case of S4, it's to prove that we can create the new advertising and marketing services model. That's what we're trying to do. This data-driven model, which creates content and is pumped out digitally in a continuous 24/7 always-on world, a model which is more agile, which is understands the digital ecosystem more effectively and is efficient, and is that is unitary, that is one firm. I think that's a key issue. I mean, when I look at a McKinsey or a Goldman, those are the gold standards that I think that professional service companies. They make their mistakes too, like everybody. But I do think they are the examples in the professional service world to emulate.
And what do you think your biggest mistake was?
Well, then I will admit to publicly. So the only one I'd admit publicly, well, not the only one, but one of them, the biggest one was clearly the convertible preferred instead of ordinary stock for Ogilvy. That was a major bloomer. But the honest answer is I make mistakes every day. As I said, the trick is to have to make more good decisions than bad decisions. You can't eliminate mistakes. You always kick yourself the mistakes that you, I mean, the important ones, or the ones that you think are important that you make.
And what would you tell a 20-year-old Martin Sorrell?
In what context?
Just in the sense that you could rewrite or redo something in the next 40 years from that point.
I think read a depressing piece from Niall Ferguson. Neil. Neil. I always call him Niall. You always get
who was on our show.
Yeah, he was so eloquent you gave him two shows.
Yes. That's right.
And I just read this depressing piece about the UK and Brexit and COVID and devolution, Scottish devolution, Ireland, United Ireland. And so whenever anybody says what advice would you give, I said learn Chinese code. And I still think that's probably the best advice because it, I think you have to think about things beyond. We're talking about somebody here in the UK. You have to think beyond UK. And if I look at S4's future, we have a strong business here in the UK, but we're 70% North and South America, we're 20% Western Europe, and 10% Asia Pacific. And I want it to be 40-20-40. So that tells you where I think you have to place your bets, if you like. And I think it's North and South America and Asia Pacific and the Middle East and Africa. I think Western Europe is going to be sticky. In Neil's piece, he was commenting about the EU's lack of response on vaccination and lack of effectiveness on vaccination. So he quoted somebody at AstraZeneca. He didn't quote, he actually didn't say who it was. So he said, somebody at AstraZeneca said, now I understand more about Brexit because it referred to the fact that the EU had been so ineffective and Kate Bingham had been so effective on vaccination development. I'm really worried about that. And when I look at S4, I think the UK has to do is to pivot. So our trade patterns have always been, and Brexit obviously is the deal, quotes unquote, that was done. But we have to change our trading pattern. And so instead of having 40 or 50% of our trade with the EU, it has to be with North and South America and Asia Pacific and the Middle East and Africa. That's where the growth is going to come. And Western Europe as a proportion of GDP will continue to decline.
Well, much as Neil Ferguson was outstanding and is outstanding, I think that we maybe should have Ambrose Evans-Pritchard on the show because he gives the bull case for the UK, which I am persuaded by. Now, a couple of final questions. You're on a podcast. Two of us started this just over a year ago. We're old dogs trying to learn new tricks, which is why we're lucky to have hired two digital folks, Tatiana and Oliver. Where's podcasting going and how does that feature in this media landscape?
Well, I think podcasting, like influencer marketing, is a subset of audio. And Clubhouse, that's instant podcasting. I mean, probably your biggest competition is Clubhouse. And I did one on Friday night, went on for about 2 hours. I'm doing one again on next Friday. I don't think it'll be quite as long. No, I mean, audio is doing well. I mean, whether, you know, it's audio books or whether it's podcasts like this or whether it's Clubhouse. So I think the tide is with you. How significant it is in the overall, if digital media is 250 billion or media as a whole is 500, 550 billion, whatever it is, how big it is in that context, I don't know, but it's an important subset. Now, the other thing, of course, to remember is how much of it has been driven by COVID and the fact that we have so much more time at home, less traveling, etc. But interesting, going back to Neil's note again, which I totally agree with, is the pattern of living is going to change as a result of COVID. I mean, COVID has accelerated digital transformation. It's been a terrible thing for me to say, but a positive from our point of view, because it's accelerated transformation at a consumer level and at a media level and at an enterprise level. And as Neil quite rightly points out, my travel habits are going to be different. I'm going to travel less. I'm going to do more Zoom meetings. Our people are going to do less time in the office, maybe 3 days a week. It's going to have more dispersed working, more dispersed living, more variation in commuting times. I mean, it's going to be much more flexibility. And I think if there's anything good to come out of it, I think that is good. So there will be a splurge, a roaring 20s type splurge. There is a coiled spring at the moment amongst consumers where the savings are huge as a result of the monetary and fiscal stimulus. And you see that coiled spring with companies too. Companies have reduced their budgets. They've cut their spending. They've shifted money into digital, which has been good for us too, but they've reduced their budgets and they've saved money. And I think there is a coiled spring ready to leap forward.
Yeah. Well, I just finishing on podcasting. Daniel Ek, founder of Spotify, thinks there'll be 1 billion listeners to podcasts within a decade. So there is a tailwind
there.
Well,
he has a small vested interest. But I was listening to Spotify on the weekend. It's great because you can, it's what Netflix should do. I think they should have a model which is an advertising model, which is cheaper than a premium model, which doesn't cost anything, and a premium model where if you don't want advertising, you don't have to have it.
Two final questions. You've met, heard, advised, and eaten with some of the most dynamic and successful people in the world. If you could take two...
Or not.
But if you could take two people for dinner, one male, one female, who would they be and where would you go?
Well, I had to go to Burger King. When I did the Financial Times, you know, we have these things called Whoppers. These are clients which are more than $20 million ahead. And I said to when the Financial Times wanted to do the lunch, I said it should be at Burger King. And they said, no, you can't do that because we've just interviewed the head of McDonald's or McDonald's. We can't have McDonald's or Burger King. But the journalist said, I'll put in, you want to have Burger King, which he didn't do, which I was very upset about. It's probably the only thing I was upset about in the interview. In terms of, you know, I'd love to have my dad back. And I think I'd like another male one, just for me, either Jules Thorne or Lord Weinstock would be great. On women, Golda Meir.
Great Israeli PM. Yeah. Why not? My gosh, nobody's ever offered that up as a guest for lunch. Fantastic. Fantastic. Okay. Well, finally, a question we ask our guests. It's off that really lovely book. If you could tell our listeners just one thing.
One thing?
Yep.
Well, I suppose when you get knighted, you don't have to, you design a shield. And I went to the Royal College of Heraldry, which is an amazing place. I think it was burnt down in the Great Fire of London. And it was redone, but they do have the shields going back to the Battle of Hastings in 1066. And in fact, I hadn't realized, those chevrons are still on a shield with bolts. And I thought those were designs. And they're not designs. Those are iron sort of bars and bolts to keep, because the shields were made of wood and they used to get hacked about during battle. So in order to keep them in one piece, you put these chevrons and things. So I always remember looking up the oldest shield and seeing that. Anyway, the point of the story is that you have to design a crest and a motto, and you can have it in Latin. And mine is in Latin, is persistence and speed. So that would be my advice. Be persistent and be speedy.
So the only association I've had with the School of Heraldry, I think, was on Her Majesty's Secret Service, where James Bond goes to find out about the de Blochon lineage before he meets Telly Savalas. Anyway, Martin, it's been a fantastic conversation. This is a once-in-a-lifetime for me. I'm going to take two things away. One is a piece of advice for young. I have three children. I will be repeating it at dinner tonight, which is learn to code. And secondly,
And Chinese,
and be persistent, because there's no substitute for
and
that.
speedy.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to let you go.
Never give up.
Good luck with your very exciting journey. Long may it continue.
And you, Simon. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.